Hey, let's go ahead and get started if we can. We have a box for you to turn in your homework now. It says turn in box. We also have a box for you to pick up the homework which has been graded. I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to pass that box around so you can find your homework. There you go. Okay, we're going to have another guest speaker. She's coming at the end of the hour today. So I'm going to try and finish up my part by about 10:15. And then we're going to actually have a very interesting guest speaker today. Is it too loud? No? It's okay. It seems very loud to me. So I had a couple of interesting things that I wanted to tell you about. One of the things that we're trying to do at Rice as part of a new design project that we want to offer in the coming years is to offer design projects for multidisciplinary groups of students that might include bioengineering students, but might also include social science and humanities students and policy students. And so one of the things that our team of researchers and faculty has been doing is to talk with people who are running international health programs about what are some of the problems that their clinics face that it could be that teams of our undergraduate students would be capable of designing solutions to solve those problems. And so we talked with Dr. Perkerson, who came and spoke on Tuesday about some of the problems that they face in their clinic in Honduras. And this morning, Yvette and Christine and I were on the phone with several nurses who are on staff at a pediatric AIDS clinic in Botswana. And this is a clinic that was established as part of the Baylor Pediatric AIDS Initiative, and it was a very, very interesting conversation. And so when we were talking with them about some of the problems that they face day to day, I thought it might be interesting just to share those with you as examples of some of the real-world challenges that they face there. And so one of the very first problems that they brought up was storage of medicines at home. One of the challenges with treating HIV and AIDS patients is that many of these drugs have to be kept cold. Their potency goes down quite a bit if they get warm. And of course, Botswana is a very warm country, and many of the people there cannot afford refrigerators at their homes. And so they tell the patients to keep the drugs in the coolest place in their home. Well, many times that's on the floor. And one of the problems is that children can then find the medicine, and obviously that's not a good thing. And so one of the things that they thought would be a big advantage was to design containers that would be child safe, that could keep these medicines cool for up to a month. And that also would be discreet, because there's a very big social stigma associated with being identified as someone who is HIV positive, and so it's important for these containers to be discreet as well. Although one of the comments that the nurse made in our conversation this morning is she said, you know, when you're facing a crisis, can we really afford to be so private? And so it's something that they struggle with on a daily basis there. Another thing that they struggle with is compliance issues. So if caregivers don't give the medicines on a regular schedule, the same time every day, then resistance can develop. And so they talked about a number of challenges that they face. Many of their caregivers are grannies, older ladies who are taking care of their relatives. And if their eyesight is failing and they have to load a syringe, say to 2.2 cc's, if they can't see the numbers on the syringe, they can't deliver the appropriate dose of medicine. And so they end up either underdosing or overdosing children on these AIDS medicines. And so if you had a syringe that you could set to a predetermined level before you sent it home, for example, that would be a very simple technology that could solve some of the problems that they face on a daily basis. Pill cutters, in order to cut the pills, if they don't have the pills available in the right dosage, you found that when you were doing homework number 4. you needed to purchase medicine in a particular dosage, and one of the clinics, I think it was Walgreens, didn't have the medicine at the particular dosage that was recommended. They said they have only one pill cutter, and they're serving, was it 10,000 patients or 1,000 patients? I forget the exact number. They have one pill cutter. And so it's just not practical for their pharmacy to cut the pills for all of the patients before they send them home. And so a pill cutter that was inexpensive enough to send home with patients along with their medicine. Educational materials. That was another big need that they have. So in terms of educating mothers about the importance of delivering these medicines according to a set schedule, they were talking about how they try to set up education sessions. So maybe in the hour before clinic starts, they would try and have an education session. One of the challenges is they've got to go off and start clinic. It's a very busy clinic. They don't have time to answer all the questions that the moms have about the medicines that they have to deliver. And so providing educational materials to a population that can't read in many cases was something that they struggle with. Inconsistent and rotating caregivers. If you had a pill box so that they would know what medicine to give when the primary caregiver was unavailable. So it was very interesting for us just to hear about some of the problems that they face on a daily basis that really some very simple technologies might be able to address. Okay, what I want to do today is we're going to move from Unit 1, where we were looking at what are the major health problems worldwide, into looking at Unit 2, which is who pays to solve problems in healthcare. And we're going to see that this varies quite a bit throughout the world, and that solutions that are developed to solve problems in healthcare really have to take this into account. Last time, we took a look at leading causes of death for people aged 45 to 59, compared those causes of death in developing and developed countries. And interestingly, we saw that the top three causes of death are the same in developed and developing countries in this age group. And remember, for children under the age of 5, they were very, very different between developed and developing countries. So what we've done is we've gone through Unit 1, we've taken a look at what is health, what does the WHO do, what types of health data are we interested in, and compared and contrasted leading causes of death. What I want to do now is I want to move into our second unit and talk about what is a health system, what is the goal of a health system, what are the parts of a health system, and how do health systems differ throughout the world. And really what we're trying to do in Unit 2 is we're trying to address the question that every nation faces, whether it has a lot of healthcare resources or whether it has a few healthcare resources. How do we use those healthcare resources in a way that best improves the health of our population? And how do we do that in a way that is fair to everyone and that responds to the needs of our population? And we heard last time from Dr. Parkerson about some of the challenges that were faced in rural Honduras. And so he talked about some of the challenges associated with maternal health care. For example, if a woman needs a cesarean section and she's in this village in rural Honduras, it's a long way away on a bumpy mountain road to a hospital where you have access to the infrastructure needed for that surgery. And that's very, very different than what we encounter here sitting across the street from the Texas Medical Center. But I wanted to make the point that it's not just developing countries that face this problem. If you look within our own country at the differences in the level of health care that are available in urban settings, such as Houston, and you compare that to rural settings, it's very, very different. And so these are my nieces, and they were born about 10 days ago. And my brother and his wife live in Nebraska. They live in a fairly small town in Nebraska. And the town where they live does not have a hospital that has a neonatal intensive care unit. And so as a result, my sister-in-law had to leave home. She has a 3-year-old, so she had to arrange for care for their 3-year-old while she was in the hospital because they didn't feel that it was safe for her to stay in Aurora, the town where they live, being so far away from a hospital that has a neonatal intensive care unit. That hospital just would not have been able to deal with the complications that were associated with delivering triplets. They were born, the smallest one weighed 3 pounds, 2 ounces when she was born, and so it was very critical that they have access to neonatal intensive care. And so as we'll see, when health systems are trying to meet the needs of their population, that it's a challenge to deal with the inequities in access to care that can exist between urban areas and rural areas. That is particularly a problem in developing countries, but it's also a problem in many developed countries as well. So in Unit 2, what we're going to do is we're going to take a look at what is a health system and what is the goal of a health system. How do health systems achieve their goal? And then we're going to look at 4 different types of health systems. And finally, how do we assess the performance of a health system? So we sort of captured all of Unit 2 here on one slide, and I'd like to take just a couple of minutes to go through this. So a health system basically is just a collection of all the resources that a country uses to address the health needs of its population. So it's the human resources, it's doctors, it's nurses, it's physical resources, it's the infrastructure to deliver healthcare. So it's primary clinics, preventive care clinics, hospitals, and then it's tertiary care centers, like MD Anderson Cancer Center, for example, is a tertiary care center. It's also the knowledge base in order to be able to diagnose, prevent, and treat disease. Research that goes into developing new healthcare technologies, and it's the economic resources. How do we pay for healthcare? So all of the resources that are devoted to healthcare make up a healthcare system. And what a health system tries to do is to take those resources and use them to try and improve the health of a population. So the primary goal of a health system is to improve the health of a population. Secondary goal of a health system is to do this in a way that is fair to all of the citizens within that population. So the health system plays 4 roles. It generates the human resources, the infrastructure, and the knowledge for healthcare. It actually delivers the healthcare services. That's part of the job of the health system. And then it has to raise the economic resources. And it also is going to try and pool economic resources so that when people get sick, they aren't faced with also paying for their own healthcare at a time when they probably can least afford it. So pooling economic resources is a very important function of health systems. And then they have to determine the rules that patients have to follow, that healthcare providers have to follow, and that people who pay for healthcare have to follow. And that's one of the most important functions that a government provides, is to provide stewardship for the healthcare system, is to set the rules and to make sure people follow the rules. As we'll see, there are 4 main different types of health systems, and they're listed here in order of decreasing market intervention. So the one that has the most market intervention is an entrepreneurial healthcare system. The United States is a good example of an entrepreneurial healthcare system. We will examine also welfare-oriented healthcare systems where the government has more of a role to play, and we'll take a look at Canada as an example of that. A comprehensive healthcare system is characterized by more government involvement, and a socialist health system, basically the government runs everything associated with the health system. And so we're going to take a look today at an example of the U.S. health system and the Canadian health system. And then we'll take a look at a couple of developing countries and the challenges that their health systems face as well. So I think I've said everything on this slide. What I want to do to start us off looking at health systems is I want to ask the question, how much as a society are we willing to spend to gain 1 year of healthy life? How much do you think it is? We draw the line somewhere. We don't pay for all treatments. So where do we draw the line? Any guesses? $100,000. You read ahead. That's exactly where we draw the line. What size T-shirt are you?
XL.
Oh, I might not have brought any XLs. I used to only make XLs, and then everyone complained that they were too big. I'll bring you an XL next time. I'm sorry. It's the only size I didn't bring. Okay, $100,000 is where we draw the line. How do we decide? Well, that's a great question. And what we do to answer that question, I'm going to go into in just a minute. What we try and do is we try and look at, for a given treatment, what is the economic cost associated with that treatment divided by the health benefit associated with that treatment. And what people have done when they try and draw that line is they'll look at that ratio of cost to benefit and take a look at where it makes sense to draw the line in terms of still being able to afford to pay for all the healthcare needs of our population, but not restricting access to services that could really have a big impact on the health of our population. What size are you? Medium. Okay, I brought medium. Okay, so let's take a look at examples of this ratio. I'm going to throw this at you, so there you go. Let's take a look at how we calculate this ratio. So we want in the numerator cost, and we want in the denominator health benefit. There are several ways that people quantify the benefit. We can put the number of years of life that are gained by a treatment. We can put the number of quality-adjusted years of life gain, or we can put the number of disability-free years of life gain. We're going to look at using what's called the QALY measure, the quality-adjusted years of life gain. And let's just take a look at the examples of some different treatments or preventive measures and how much we have to spend to gain one quality-adjusted year of life. And so if we look at this table, here are some various therapies, and here's how much it costs to gain one quality-adjusted year of life with that therapy. Some things actually save money, and we've looked at two of those already. Motorcycle helmets actually generate cost savings, and seat belts generate cost savings, and childhood immunizations generate cost savings. Question?
Do treatments that have a limited availability in the transplant policy category, or do they get separate ones? Not everyone is
treated in one. We could, for a treatment like a transplant, we could put that in our table. And so bone marrow transplant, for example, we can calculate how much do we have to spend presuming that we can find a match to save a quality-adjusted year of life. What size would you like?
Small.
Small, okay. Okay. So if you wear your T-shirt on the day of the exam, you get extra credit. I once got a comment back on my teaching evaluations that said, I got an A in your class and I never once had to wear a T-shirt on exam day. Person was very proud of that. Okay, so if we take a look at how much, since we looked in our table of the leading causes of loss of disability-adjusted life years, Remember how important depression was in that table? It showed up in many of our tables. And the use of antidepressants for people with major depression only cost $1,000 to gain 1 year of life through the use of antidepressants. Treating hypertension to prevent myocardial infarction or heart attack, also a very, very cost-effective intervention. Pap smear screening for cervical cancer, we'll come back to this in our third unit. Again, a very cost-effective intervention. Airbags. Seatbelts save money. Airbags cost money, but still fairly cost-effective. Now we take a look at another intervention that we've talked about, chemotherapy in a fairly elderly woman who has breast cancer. Cost $58,000 to gain 1 year of life with that treatment. But that's something that we've chosen in our country to pay for. Okay, here's one. Dialysis in seriously ill patients who have renal failure. Well, it turns out that this is about where we've chosen to draw the line in terms of what we feel is a good use of healthcare resources. Here's another example that we'll talk about in Unit 3. Do we screen everybody, the general population, for HIV? No, we don't feel that that's a cost-effective use of resources because we would have to spend $1.5 million for every year of life that we would gain by screening the general population. And there are other ways that will give us more benefit that we should invest our resources. Question?
Yeah, what do you think we pay for the treatment of people?
I'm going to get back to your question in a little bit more detail, but the short answer is insurance companies, both private insurance companies, and then government-funded insurance plans like Medicare and Medicaid. Generally speaking, most insurance companies will not provide this reimbursement for services that you have to spend more than $100,000 a year per year of life gained. And generally what insurance companies, both private and public, will pay for is what is recommended or what is accepted as standard of care. And so we talked about consensus guidelines for standard of care. Remember we looked at one of the consensus guidelines for HIV screening, and we saw that that consensus guideline said that the consensus was you should screen high-risk patients, but not the general population. One of the ways that people get to that consensus is by looking at this ratio of cost to benefit and thinking about, you know, if we recommended doing this, we would spend so much money doing that we wouldn't have enough left to pay for some of these other measures which are much more economically beneficial. We're going to take a look next time in class at what happened in the state of Oregon during the early 1990s when the state tried to explicitly make a list ranking different types of health interventions according to this measure and then draw a line. And we'll see some of the problems that they ran into when they did that, as well as how they finally came to a solution that the rest of the country and citizens within the state were comfortable with. So it's not a simple answer, but it's a great question, and it's one that people struggle with throughout the world. What size do you need? Okay. Okay, we have another question over here. So a table is just a list of the services ranked in this way. And people use it for different reasons. Rationing is sort of the bad name that it got when it was used in Oregon in the early 1990s. And we'll see that there really are problems if you just draw a line and you don't try and think about it in a more sophisticated way.
Mm-hmm.
I would say $100,000. There's nobody who said if it's $100,001, we're not going to pay for it. It's where many developed countries have drawn the line historically. In developing countries, it's going to be a much smaller number. So depending on the amount of healthcare resources that you have available to you. No. Generally speaking, they're going to look at, do we cover a service under general circumstances, yes or no? Okay. What size did you need in the blue? Okay, and you? Okay. All right, can I get you to get them two mediums? Okay, another question. So what that number, the way that number is calculated is we would take a look at if we had a population, just the general population, let's say the entire population of the United States, we're going to screen everybody in our country tomorrow. And those people who are identified as positive, they're going to get therapy. They're going to get heart, so they'll get it sooner because we screened. They'll get it sooner because, you know, they'll get it before they even had symptoms, and so they'll live longer as a result of that. And so we can figure out how many years of life would we gain. That's what's going to go in the denominator. And in the numerator, what's the cost of a test multiplied by the number of people that we test? That's the cost. And so that's the way that that is calculated. So you have to define what's your population, what would be the cost to provide that intervention to that population, and how many years of life would you end up saving. So it is a complicated calculation. We won't actually learn how to do the calculation because it's so complex. You'll do one homework where you kind of do a bit of an estimate, but you'll focus on estimating costs, not quality adjusted life years, because that really is a complex calculation to do. Okay. Any other questions? Oh, I don't know if we have mediums left, do we? I have small and large. You want to wait?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. So, what happens in our country if you don't have health insurance and you need a transplant? I want to go, actually, we're going to go to the state of Oregon, but in the United States, what happens if you don't have private health insurance? If you meet certain income guidelines, you qualify for basically state government-sponsored insurance called Medicaid. The Medicaid rules, both the eligibility and the fraction of population that are covered, vary quite a bit from state to state. In Texas, SSI recipients and welfare recipients qualify for Medicaid in the state of Texas. And what happens if a person has Medicaid is that the state government pays for a portion of their health care costs, and the federal government also pays for a portion of their health care costs. So let's suppose you don't have private insurance, you have Medicaid, but Medicaid doesn't cover the service that you need. What happens then? You either pay for it yourself or you don't get it. So let's go to the state of Oregon now and take a look at what the Oregon health system was trying to do. We're going to go back to 1987. At that time, the Oregon state constitution required that the state budget be balanced, and any surplus that was left was to be returned to taxpayers. Now, Oregon was really struggling with rising medical expenditures. Medical expenditures were rising faster than the state tax revenues were rising. And at the same time, they wanted to be able to expand the fraction of their population who was covered by Medicaid. So they wanted to reduce the number of people in Oregon who had no health insurance, but they were struggling with this economic reality. And so they tried to expand coverage in the following way. What they did was they said they're going to end Medicaid coverage of transplants. And instead, they're going to provide prenatal care so that all pregnant women who are on Medicaid would have access to prenatal care. And their reasoning was that typically every year, Medicaid paid for 10 transplants in the state of Oregon, and they spent between $100,000 and $200,000 per transplant. It ended up costing the state about $1.1 million to pay for those transplants. The federal government paid for the rest of it. But if they took this $1 million and instead of providing transplants, they provided prenatal care, they reasoned that they would be able to save the lives of 25 babies. And so they decided that it was better to pay for prenatal care and save the lives of 25 babies than to pay for transplants for 10 citizens in Oregon. So what happened next was that there was a young boy in August of 1987. His name was Kobe Howard. He was 7 years old at the time, and he developed leukemia. And he needed a bone marrow transplant to treat his leukemia. Now, he was covered under Oregon State Medicaid, but since Medicaid had just eliminated coverage for transplants, he was denied coverage for the bone marrow transplant that he needed. Now, his mother appealed to the legislature, but they denied the coverage. And so she tried to raise the money for his transplant, which was going to be about $70,000. So she tried to raise money for this through a media campaign. And she was able to raise part of the goal, but before he received treatment, he died in December of 1987 as a result of his leukemia. And one of the attorneys who was involved in the case said that Kobe was really forced to spend the last days of his life acting cute in front of a TV camera, trying to raise money to pay for the transplant that he needed. Now, at the same time, there was another boy who was 2 years old who also lived in Oregon. His name was David Holliday, and he developed leukemia as well. His mom decided just to move to the state of Washington. The family lived in their car, but the state of Washington did not have any minimum residency requirement to qualify for Medicaid, and Medicaid in Washington did provide transplants. David was able to get the transplant that he needed to treat his leukemia. And so I think what this illustrates is that not just in developing countries, but everywhere throughout the world, health systems really face difficult choices. They have limited resources, they have citizens who need health care, and they have to try and meet those needs in a way that is fair. And clearly this is an example where there were very gross inequities in access to health care depending on what state you lived in. So we've talked about the primary goal of a health system. We've talked about the secondary goal of a health system, achieving improved health in a way that is fair. And I think one of the most important things that health systems try to do is to protect their citizens against the unpredictable costs of an illness that you face at a time when you have the least capacity and many times to pay for it. What we'll see is that in many developing countries, citizens have to pay for their health expenditures out of their own pocket. And that results in the fact that illness is often a cause of poverty, because people have to pay so much of the cost of their care out of their own pockets. When we have the infrastructure in place to offer health insurance so that you can prepay those health expenditures, then we can protect people against these unpredictable costs. When we look at health systems throughout the world, we'll see that they're going to reflect historical trends in economic development as well as historical trends in political ideology. And we've talked about the four important functions that health. I'm going to skip that because we've covered it already. and go into the economic classification of different types of health systems. So there are four different political classifications of health systems. The entrepreneurial system, we've talked about the system in the United States, it's strongly influenced by market forces with some government intervention. So Medicaid and Medicare are examples of government intervention. In a welfare-oriented health system, we have mandated health insurance programs for all workers. So Canada is an example of a health system which is welfare-oriented. And so the government is going to mandate that all workers have some type of health insurance. These may be provided through private companies. They may be provided through the government. In a comprehensive health system, and the United Kingdom is a great example of a comprehensive health system, we're going to provide complete coverage to 100% of our population, almost exclusively through tax revenues. And then in a socialist health system, Cuba is an example of a socialist health system. We're going to have the government operating all health services, and at least in theory, these are freely available to all citizens. This is a chart. This is a bit of older data. This chart was from a paper that came out in 1993, and it divides different countries according to the type of health system that they have. So entrepreneurial, welfare-oriented, comprehensive, and socialist, and it stratifies them by the income level of the country. So high income developed, middle income developing, and low income developing countries. What I want to do in the last 10 minutes is compare health systems throughout the world. So we're going to take a look at the United States, we're going to take a look at Canada to compare an entrepreneurial and a welfare-oriented health system. We're probably not going to have time to get through India and Angola, but I posted the newest draft of Chapter 5, and you can read about those there. Take a look at this graph. This is a graph that shows the percentage of the population versus life expectancy at birth. And this is for four countries, Japan, Mexico, Norway, and the United States. And we're going to show data for women in green and for men in gray. Which of those countries do you think has the health system which is the most fair? Norway. Why do you pick Norway? Okay, so less gap between men and women in Norway. Anybody have a different choice? No? Okay. Okay, so I think you hit upon a very important point, which is providing access to care to everybody. So if everybody has equal access to care, what do you think would happen to the distribution here? Probably it's going to shift. What happens to the width of the distribution if everybody has equal access to care? It will narrow. Okay, which country has the narrowest distribution here? Japan. What happens in the United States? Look at the tails of this distribution. Okay, so this is actually a very interesting way to look at fairness of a health system. And many people feel that by this measure, Japan has one of the fairest health systems in the world. What size are you? Small. Okay, there you go. Okay, and what size are you? Small. Okay. I think I have one small left. Oh, all I have is large. I'm sorry. I'll bring some smalls next time. Do you have a question? No? Okay. This is another interesting way to look at the fairness of a health system. What I've done here is I plotted the percentage of total health expenditures that come from private sources. That's what the yellow bar shows. Okay? So if it doesn't come from a private source, it comes from a government source. So what's not provided by yellow comes from the government. I've ranked these countries in order of lowest per capita health expenditures to highest per capita health expenditures. And we've got developing countries down here. Here's Angola, Bangladesh, China, and here's developed countries: the United Kingdom, Japan, Canada, Germany, and the United States. Okay, take a look at the contrast between developing and developed countries. Most of the developing countries, more than half of their health expenditures come from private sources, not from the government. It might be foreign aid in some cases, but much of it comes from the pockets of the citizens there. If we compare that to our developed countries, countries that have welfare-oriented systems, Japan, Canada, and Germany, the government is paying for at least 3/4 of the health expenditures. The United Kingdom has a comprehensive health system. The government's paying for more than 95% of the health expenditures. Now, what the citizens have to pay out of their own pockets, that's the white bar. So you can look in the United States, more than half of our health expenditures come from private sources, but most of it's private insurance. Only less than 20% of it comes out of the pockets of citizens. But if you look in developing countries, look how big these white bars are compared to the yellow bars. People there have to pay for much of their health expenditures out of their own pockets. Question?
For the bar that includes the private insurance, are they including in that the premiums that you have to pay for?
Yes. So out of pocket is defined to be what you pay at the time that you seek care. So it would include a copayment if you had a copayment, but it would not include health insurance premiums because that would be a prepaid expenditure. So out-of-pocket is defined to be when you go to the hospital or you go to the doctor, what do you have to pay in order to get service?
Okay. Mm-hmm. So this graph, in a way, kind of underestimates the amount that is actually contributed by the patient.
It does, because what it's trying to do is to get at how much is out-of-pocket expense a barrier to care. How many people don't go to the doctor because they can't afford to pay for the health care? And you know, it was interesting, on our call this morning with the nurses in Botswana, they were talking about one of the things that causes people not to seek care is not because they can't afford the clinic services, but because they can't afford the transportation cost to get to the clinic. And so it's not always just the cost of those health services, but it's the cost of missing work, it's the cost of having to pay for transport to get there. That also is not included here. So, mm-hmm. So for life-threatening conditions, they have to provide care.
Okay,
you cannot turn away a patient who has a life-threatening condition. But if it's a non-life-threatening condition, then you don't have to provide care. And so the burden for caring for uninsured patients falls, in many cases, disproportionately on county hospitals, public hospitals. We'll see also that not all providers in the United States will accept patients who are Medicaid patients, for example, and that in many cases the reimbursement rates for Medicaid are less than the cost of providing care, and that's a very big disincentive to provide care for that population. You're going to lose money taking care of those patients because the amount that you get reimbursed by the government is less than the amount that it costs you to provide that service.
So the city would have
Okay. So in the entrepreneurial U.S. healthcare system, we've talked a little bit now about how we pay for care. We pay for care through a combination of private insurance Many times that is employer-sponsored insurance. So as one of your fringe benefits for having a job, you have the ability to purchase health insurance at discounted group rates. And there are several types of insurance. There's conventional insurance, which is becoming less and less common, and there's managed care insurance, including health maintenance organizations, preferred provider organizations, and point of service plans. I'll give you some reading about the difference between these three types of plans because we're going to run out of time today. So there's private insurance. There's the government. The government provides care for senior citizens through Medicare, for poor citizens through Medicaid, and for children through state children's health insurance plans. And then for people who have no insurance, their only way to pay for care is out of their own pocket. I'm going to show you just a couple of quick graphs in terms of, in the United States, where the money to pay for care comes from. So we spend in our country every year about $1.3 trillion on health care. It's a big number. About a third of that comes from private insurance. About 15% of that comes from out-of-pocket payments. And then about 45% of that comes from the government. Okay, it comes through Medicare, Medicaid, and children's health insurance programs, and then Veterans Affairs programs, other public programs. If we look, I think this is a very interesting map. If you take a look at the fraction of births that are paid for by Medicaid, this is by state. And remember, the states have different coverage rules about eligibility for Medicaid. So let's look at the state of Texas. Yeah, there are age requirements for Medicare. Yes, that is national. Mm-hmm. So in the state of Texas, more than 40% of births are funded by Medicaid. And so, again, you can see very dramatic geographic differences. So where the money comes from, 45% of our health expenditures are paid for by the government. About 40% come from private sources. About 15% come from out-of-pocket. You had a question? It has to do, I think, with two factors. It has to do just with the economics, the income distribution within those states. They vary from state to state. It has a lot to do with how much of the state is urban versus rural as well. And then it has to do with eligibility rules, which vary quite widely. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we are actually going to not get through the rest of the slides today. What I would like to do instead is we have a special guest speaker who is going to join us and talk about a very interesting topic. So let me skip ahead to my introduction slide. Oh, you do have one assignment due next time, which is homework number 5. It's one of my favorite homeworks. I think you'll find it very interesting. I also want to let you know that we're going to post, I think by Friday, we're going to post the revised project assignments. I'll talk more next time about the specific details of the project, but basically what you're going to do in the project is you're going to work in small groups. You're going to choose a disease that you're interested in. And one of the things you're going to do is you're going to write an editorial that we will actually, you'll submit to the newspaper of your choice, arguing for investment of some type, either in research or funding to improve the diagnosis, the treatment, or the prevention of that disease. So you should be thinking about who do you want to work with in your group. The minimum group size is 2. The maximum group size is 4. The other thing that you'll be doing is you'll be thinking about a new technology that can improve the diagnosis, the treatment, or the prevention of that disease, and you'll be making a mock-up of that technology. It doesn't have to be a functional mock-up. It just has to be a visually interesting and explanatory mock-up of that technology, and we'll be presenting those toward the end of class. So the first project assignment, I believe, is due a week from today, which is basically to choose your disease. But be thinking about who you want to work with in your group and what disease you are interested in. So with that, I'd like to introduce our guest. We have Professor Kirsten Oster, who is on the faculty in English here at she is on sabbatical this semester, but was in town over the days and agreed graciously to come and talk to us about a very interesting topic, which is the application of film, TV, and news media to issues in globalization and public health. So let me go ahead and turn it over to her. And right in here.
So this will be my control panel down here. I should start it so that it will get to where.
So let's close that.
Actually, I just need to get to the menu.
Oh, okay.
If we can, we can go back to that other one and just press play.
Okay.
I think it'll bring me to the menu. Oh, yeah, there we go. Okay. Selection, is that going to go? How do I make this go to the whole screen? Is it this one?
All right, so okay. So one of the main questions that I address in my research on film and television is a question that I think you all are going to be dealing with maybe already, but certainly later on in this course, which is how do medical and scientific developments reach the general public? So in a way, you could say that I deal with questions about the diffusion of new technologies and knowledge. Today, I'm going to give you a very brief historical perspective on how film and television have been used to promote ideals of public health in the post-World War II period, when ideas about world health and globalization, public health as an element of modernization, were really coming to the fore. And you'll see from the clips that I show you that the style of representation has changed a lot. What you see on television now doesn't look anything like this. But the point that I want you to take away from this is that there are some continuities with the form of representation that I think people need to be very aware of, because there are certain kinds of problems in the ways that stereotypical forms of representation get embedded and represented over and over again in news media that deals especially with health issues in the developing world. So when you look at the older clips that I'm going to show you, think about how they might have bearing on what goes on today. Okay, so just a little bit of brief background. The global scale of both the Centers for Disease Control and the WHO's pursuit of public health after World War II created an enormous demand for personnel trained in health surveillance techniques, which presented in turn what was seen at that time as the need for a universal form of communication. Film was seen as this form of communication because it is visual, because you don't necessarily have to speak the language in order to understand what's going on there. So the shortage of experts available to respond to what seemed like these suddenly urgent demands of world health prompted the Centers for Disease Control to invest in efficient and mass reproducible technologies of instruction. So you might not usually think of film as a technology, but in fact, it was crucial in developing a level of care for public health problems so that there could be an actual trained workforce very quickly. Okay, so, you know, this the film as a tool was used not just to train public health workers, but also to disseminate the ideals of world health more broadly. Consequently, the medium of film attained a uniquely privileged status in promoting world health during and after World War II. There were a lot of health films that were made for all different kinds of audiences, the general public, physicians, school children, all different kinds of groups. Audiovisual materials had played a crucial role in CDC's prehistory as malaria control in war areas. That organization first employed instructional films to train a huge staff in the techniques for eradicating malaria-bearing mosquitoes during World War II, so that troops that were stationed in areas where they would be exposed to this problem, you know, wouldn't all just get sick and not be able to fight. So they used films to train people in how to do that quickly. After the war, CDC training films were in such high demand that they launched their own production studios. So from this perspective, you can see that CDC's prestige as a post-war global health surveillance organization was in some ways promoted as much by their mastery and distribution of audiovisual technologies as it was by the actual control of infectious disease that they were doing. There had to be this step of promoting the work that they were doing on a global scale. And the CDC's media projects reached both scientific and popular audiences. The U.S. Public Health Service also produced a series of health education motion pictures for the information and guidance of the general public during the post-war period. And when CDC had new headquarters constructed in 1960, they built an entire building just for the audiovisual unit. They had a huge sound, they had two sound stages, several dark rooms, a state-of-the-art production facility there. So again, you might not think of CDC as a film studio, but in fact, that was seen as a really crucial part of them doing their work. The WHO was also engaged in making a lot of films at this time too, though usually by contracting people to make them for them, not developing their own film studios. And I know that you're going to be studying the World Health Organization, so I thought that you might appreciate a couple of clips from the first film I want to show you, called The Eternal Fight. It was a film that was produced for the United Nations Film Board in 1948, and it's very similar to other films produced in this period, so I thought it would be representative for you in a useful way. And you can see that in this film, the sources of contagious disease are identified with specific national sources outside of the United States and Western Europe. So there's a real sense of disease being spread around the globe in only particular ways. And this film itself combines a fictionalized account of the spread of a particular disease with a discussion of the ease with which diseases can be spread around the globe. So in this period especially, people were really concerned that airplanes were going to lead to mass contamination, even at the same time as they thought that they would lead to the possibility for modernization and development everywhere. So there's this kind of contradiction that happens perpetually, where the same tools that seem to enable improvement in world health seem to threaten the decline of world health. Okay, so here's The Eternal Fight. Oh, will I have sound here? Oh, it's not going. Whoops.
Oh, you know what? I turned it down. I'm about to put this up. Sorry.
Hold on. I press pause.
Okay.
There you go.
Zone, the traveler now became, unwittingly, a carrier of deadly germs. Wherever he went, the germs stayed and spread. Epidemics break out far from the known infected areas. Country to country, continent to continent, the deadly cargo of microbes is transported, menacing on a vast scale the very existence of humanity. Mass infection and epidemics are a threat to every city, to every nation. Scientific and medical work on a local scale are no longer enough. Thus, in common defense, quarantine measures extended, frontier control set up. When an epidemic strikes, that country is subjected to special restrictive measures. Suspected carriers are isolated. And step by step, the dangers of contagion grow less and less.
All right, so you can see in that clip, and you will see it more in the next clip I'm going to show you as well, that the benefits of modernization that seem to establish the boundaries between developed and underdeveloped countries are themselves identified as vectors of contagion. And so although on the one hand you have this collapse of space and time that seems to be enabled by technology, in other words, people are moving around more quickly than ever, you know, this is on the one hand a benefit of modernity and on the other hand a threat to the world, as I was just saying earlier. So now the handshake that you saw a minute ago, it's not mentioned by name in that last clip, but it's meant to represent the League of Nations. And on the one hand, you can see that the end of this clip is meant to be very triumphant and happy. And, you know, obviously we've figured out how to use national boundaries to control the spread of disease. But then this quickly becomes more complicated. And this is from a little bit later in the film.
Do I just press pause again? That's what I pressed. Sorry.
Okay, well listen, as we're getting this back up, I just want to tell you what you can look at in the next clip. Is the way that the balance of geopolitical power is itself seen as a component of global health surveillance. You'll see this contradiction happening over and over again, that globalization is both the cause and the cure of the spread of disease. The thing that I really want you to see in the clips that I'm going to show you are that the way that this understanding of how disease is spread around the world is often represented on film by showing images of the inhabitants of a nation who are themselves supposed to represent diseased bodies. So this is a problem that reappears, that reappears in public. I'm going to jump ahead to the next. I'm going to jump ahead to another clip in this film.
Infected zones are localized, but they cover large areas of territory, sometimes entire countries. Then, what is the answer?
So here you have a very clear model of the movement of vaccines into the general population. And I think it'll be useful for you to keep that in mind as you think about the projects that you're actually working on in this class. I'm not going to be able to show you the clip from the television because I think these, I don't think we have time to get into that and both cover just the general points I want to conclude by making. One of the things that you can see in this clip is another contradiction that pervades a lot of the and television coverage of world health problems, which is that on the one hand, it is true that infectious disease disproportionately affects developing countries. On the other hand, by representing the inhabitants of those countries as the bearers of disease, these films often unintentionally produce a visual association of whiteness with purity and non-whiteness with disease or contamination. And so you have this really complicated situation that you see in current television coverage of global disease outbreaks now. So think about this when you watch coverage of the avian influenza threat, for instance. The other television clip that I wanted to show you was about a 1957 outbreak of Asian influenza, as they were calling it at the time. So you can see over and over again that the same people who are clearly identified as the people who need help are also highlighted again and again as diseased. And so this reproduces a certain form of understanding, which in itself over time can have negative effects on the populations that are themselves the object of assistance, improvement, modernization efforts. So that's the basic point that I wanted you all to take away from looking at this older film. When you see this clip, I mean, it's humorous, you know, it seems very dated, but this was made by the United Nations, so, this was a very serious film that was meant to promote very serious activities. And what I think is the case is that the kinds of visual images that happen in a film like this still happen very much in mass media coverage of disease. So pay attention to that as you are thinking about how problems in developing countries and disease get worked out and get publicized broadly. I'll leave it at that, and if anyone has any questions. Sure. You're welcome.